Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Banking Matters. I'm your host, Ashton Woodling. Joining me today is Helen Touchton. Helen has 30 years of financial services industry experience and is currently an independent BSA AML compliance consultant. She started her career at the Royal Bank of Scotland in the UK and worked in several banks in Florida and Illinois in retail, operational, BSA, and compliance positions. After working in institutions for over 17 years, she switched to the role of consultant, working for two different firms in Illinois before branching out on her own in 2020. Now, as the owner of Touchton Compliance Consulting, LLC, Helen helps financial institutions and fintech firms across the country strengthen their BSA AML programs by performing independent BSA AML audits, as well as offering customized consulting BSA AML assistance. On a personal level, I'm proud to call Helen a friend. I first met her when she performed a BSA AML audit for a mutual client and immediately felt this magnetic energy she has that just draws people in with her passion for BSA. Helen, thank you for agreeing to do a podcast episode with me.
Well, thank you, Ashton. I appreciate you doing the invite. I was a little unsure at first. Those that know me know that I am much happier behind the camera than in front of the camera. That's just me. But I really do appreciate that personal extra touch for the invitation as well. So thank you again for the invite.
I'm so happy you agreed. So one thing we do every episode of Banking Matters is we ask our guests to explain how they found their role in banking, because now, every time I say this, someone corrects me, but rarely does a child dream of growing up and dreaming of becoming a banker or some role in banking. And every time I say that, somebody says, well, actually. But anyway, how did you find yourself in banking?
And it's always funny. You're absolutely right. When you told me you were going to ask this question up front, I was like, okay, but I almost do fall into that category. I did start banking right out of high school, you know, literally at that 17, 18 year old, you know, young upstart that knew everything and nothing all at the same time. My mom had worked in a bank when she was in her 20s. And it was just one of those things. I had gone for, it was like a career school day event, and had met with some different banks there. And Royal Bank of Scotland was one of those entities that I had met with. And yes, it just kind of fell into my lap. So I started as a teller. They call them cashiers back in the UK. So I was a cashier at the Royal Bank of Scotland. I did some back office work, the old fashioned folding statements, trifold into an envelope and sticking them through the stamping machine. I did some proofing work in the back office, and at nighttime went to work as did college work. And so I was there for the bank for about a year, and then had moved to the States and continued that career in banking. So really, yes, my entire banking career, bar a couple of years, has been from one bank to another or a consulting firm. So yes, that's how I got started.
I love it. So you really did just start from the beginning. Every time I say it, somebody's like, nope.
Yeah.
So what brought you to the States from the UK?
Oh. Oh, you didn't tell me you could ask me that one. So yes, I was young, smarter than my parents, and had married a U.S. serviceman when I was just a teen, came to the States. That didn't quite last as long as my journey to the States has. But so thank you for asking that one, Ashton. Absolutely. So yes, marriage number one lasted about 7 years, was still in banking in Florida. And then the husband number two has lasted much longer and is continuing to last. And so now I've been in the States just over 30 years.
Perfect. Who knew? Okay, let's get back on track from where I deviated here. So Helen, you perform a lot of BSA AML audits and consulting work there. Tell me about what this is like from your perspective and how someone in the banks can really make the most of that experience.
Absolutely. So nobody likes audits, you know, except maybe consultants like me. Banks have to deal with audits every day, it seems. If it's not a BSA audit, maybe it's some type of compliance, an IT audit, an ACH audit. So I fully understand banks and bankers just get a little fed up with audits. They're just kind of, you know, annoying. There's all the prep work. There's the request list. There's the samples. There's annoying auditors that are asking all the questions. And then there's that dreaded exit meeting and report writing. So it's not always a bundle of joy, right? And especially if it isn't going well from a finding standpoint. And I do understand that. So most of my BSA audits are really, really fast paced. A lot of my clients, oh, on the smaller side, I'm not auditing those big ginormous boys. So I have BSA audits that might generally last, you know, 1, 2, maybe 3 weeks at most. And that's an unusual, you know, larger institution that might have, just a little bit more on the risk side of things. So they're very fast paced. And with that comes responsibilities on both sides. I need to be organized. So, you know, having an auditor that is, you know, just unorganized, all over the place, doesn't follow through with the client, that's not good. Well, same thing on the other end. If I've got a client that isn't responding to me and getting the request list completely organized on time, not getting me the samples on time, not being available when the audit starts, I can't tell you how many times that we'll plan an audit, and I do understand things change. But then on the day we start the audit, they say, oh, yes, well, 3 key people aren't going to be here for the week. Okay, well, that's a challenge, right? It makes it harder for me to get the audit done on time. It also reflects to the client that it might be that I need to be, you know, bothering you longer than we had initially, you know, thought. So certainly respect on both sides. I'm very respectful of my clients' time. I try and keep meetings on time. I definitely want to keep on schedule. If I say I'll be done in a week or 10 days, I very much try and keep up to that, barring any unforeseen circumstances. So the same thing on the client side, right? Be respectful. Just because most of the audits these days are now being done offsite, that doesn't mean to ignore your auditor. It was very easy in the old days. We were in their faces, right? They couldn't get away from us. We'd go and hang out in their doorway until they actually answered our questions. Now it's an email or a phone call, so it's a little easier for them to dodge us. But I think having that, again, that respectful relationship with your client is key. I try and absolutely put those expectations out for my kickoff meeting. I want to tell the client how this audit is going to go through. I want to explain to them our timeline. I want to explain how the audit, it should roll from start to finish, even as far as what to do when you get the report. So I think no surprises. Again, same thing on the other side. If something's happened from the client side, let me know what's happening. Be involved. I always schedule meetings throughout the engagement. So I want to let my client know how the audit's going. Hey, you know, I might have, you know, some issues with here. Can you help answer these questions? Can we go through how the bank manages their high risk customer reviews? How are they filing their SARs? Anything along the way, I want to get a better understanding of that client. My role as that auditor is to get such a good understanding of how the bank is operating that I can then do a thorough audit, not just a cursory top level audit. I want to do a deep dive, and I can only do that if I understand the bank and their operations. So that's really how I think both, you know, I want the bank to understand my approach, and I want to understand their operations. So it really is a give and take on both sides.
Perfect. So kind of make sure that we're being responsive and we're making sure. I think too, I remember as a former auditor, and I was internal, but as external, I can only imagine it's even more so. You know, you're paying for this engagement, so make sure that you're getting the most out of it by being available and prioritizing that work.
Absolutely. It's key.
Yeah. So what types of issues and findings are you seeing right now?
It really does depend. Every client is a little different. So, you know, what they are actually doing is different. Some will be banking cannabis related businesses. Some won't touch a money services business. So it can be very different in the types of operations they have. Some consistent issues still come up with CTRs and SARs. Both of those documents are really, really technical. I think at the last count, the SAR has over 100 fields that a client can, you know, mess up or get right, right? So when I take a look at CTRs, SARs, those are where I'll often see those findings. There's still some misconception out there that not all fields are required, right? Oh, well, you know, what's critical, what's non-critical? Well, I think if banks really go back and look at the FinCEN's filing instructions, they'll realize that all fields are required. It's just the terminology of the critical and non-critical field that comes important, because there certainly can be those fields that may not be critical, those asterisk fields that still need to be completed correctly, if applicable, of course. And there are definitely some times that banks, you know, don't really have a good handle on that. I would absolutely vouch that every BSA officer and their team should memorize the filing instructions and the FFIEC exam manual. Should be going to bed with it, right? They should understand exactly what to expect in those CTRs and SARs. And not all banks do a lot of them, right? So it's that age-old issue that if you don't file many SARs, maybe you have a little higher propensity of getting something wrong, right? Because it's not something that you'll do on a daily basis. If you have to manually do a lot of the entry fields rather than utilizing your system, again, that allows for those, you know, human errors to kind of creep in. Beneficial ownership form is still an area that I see findings. I see where they just forget to fill in pieces, or, well, it is a little bit of a repetitive form. Sorry, FinCEN, and, you know, those that created that form, but it is a little repetitive. We put the control person, we've got the ownership, we've got the person filling out the form. You know, you could end up writing the same name several times on there. So getting that completed and the timing of it. It is one of those forms that is very sensitive in the timing of the form. And a lot of times that's not being done, you know, in a timely manner as expected at account opening, loan origination, kind of within that time frame. Some of the other areas would be more where your risk assessment, your policy not matching practice. That's kind of a given, right? If you say you're not offering prepaid access device cards, but then your branches are selling them, there's a mismatch. You say you're not banking money services businesses or privately owned, independently owned ATMs, but you have them. So I'm always looking for that mismatch information. And then things like alerts, the automated surveillance system, I think still continues to give bankers heartburn on a daily basis for many reasons. I don't have enough time to cover all of those, but really just keeping the documentation of alerts cases, make sure it's thorough, make sure it makes sense. You know, we still have bankers that's put in their alerts, not suspicious activity, normal activity. Okay. Well, regulators have certainly indicated to a number of institutions that they want more. They don't want just to see normal activity. Explain why it's normal. What's normal for you doesn't mean it's normal for another institution. So those would be the main areas that I still see, the ticky-tacky items, and then that very subjective area of managing your alerts and that, you know, automated surveillance system monitoring piece.
Of all of those, I'm going to throw you a curveball, Helen. Which do you think is like the highest risk or that highest priority that banks really should be focusing on?
You know, I would actually have to say there's two of them. SARs are definitely a hotspot, right? If you file the SARs incorrectly, you're late filing the SARs. That's obviously, while that's not necessarily a technical content issue, having a process where you're not filing them timely is definitely a critical area. So make sure that those are being filed and the continuing SARs. I believe banks seem to have a better handling of getting those new SARs down, but when it comes down to doing the continuing SARs, it's very easy for those 90 days to creep into that 120, and then we've obviously kind of hit that timeline buffer. So SARs are, I would say, number one, but right on the cusp of that would be the automated surveillance monitoring. Every bank, every institution, they're still dealing with staffing, right? How do you work all those alerts? You have to balance the volume of alerts to my staffing, right? We don't want to tailor the system to only identify the number of alerts that my bank can manage because I have two people working them. But at the same time, we know that the systems will often generate false positives. And it's not as easy just to ignore those, right? You've got to still identify why was it a false positive? And then how do we tweak that system to make it most effective for us? And that is not an easy balance. So I would balance that. You know, I might say one bank has a higher risk on the ASM and others have a higher risk on the SARs. I think your regulator might have a, you know, a kind of a reasoning on why I switched that. I see some of the regulators might have a little higher propensity to focus on the ASM side, whereas others may not. So I would put those two at the top of my list for bankers to really try and, if they feel there's a gap, those would be the two areas I would say at least try and, you know, narrow that, smallen that gap.
Very good. And I agree with that. I have banks ask questions about continuing SARS a lot. So I know that that is the pain point. Yep. So you've been doing this for more than a few days, right? Not your first rodeo. How have audits evolved in your time in BSA or even just the past 10 years?
Absolutely. And we're back to the ASMs, the systems, right? You know, 10, 15, 20 years ago, we didn't have the same volume of automated systems, giving us that, you know, ability to look more for suspicious activity. And with every wonderful system, there's always a slight headache that comes along with it, as any bank I know that has gone through validations, changing systems, you know, retuning systems. So the focus on ASM testing certainly is something I've seen an increase on my audits, right? You have to tweak the focus of the audit to really tailor what's happening with that institution. So are they a bank that uses one of those, you know, well-known systems that you have alerts and you have cases? Are you using a very much a rule-driven system? Or behavioral driven? Is it a bit of both? Is it really just a report driven system where it's not necessarily pinging you live data where they're doing threshold, you know, might just be doing threshold system tweaks, but it's not actually doing peer data reviews. So you've got these other customers that do no cash activity, and then this one cash intensive customer is just really out of the norm. So there's a lot of different systems, which also adds a little bit of pressure for the auditors, right? We have to be able to understand each of those systems and how they work. So I've learned that even though I may not be an operator of any of those systems, I've had to learn a little more about using those systems than I ever thought I would need to, because as an auditor, you need to understand what you're auditing, right? And if I'm using, you know, maybe it's, I'll name a couple out there, right? You know, is it a Verafin? Is it a BAM Plus, a Brigo system? Is it a new monitor? Is it any of those types of systems? I need to understand how it works so that I can make sure that the banker that I'm auditing understands how it works. So I would definitely say I spend more time now on different varying pieces of the ASM system. Again, the monitoring, cases, documentation, are they doing it timely? How long does it take them to clear alerts? So definitely a part of the ASM.
Oh, you can actually barely hear it.
Oh, okay. I'll keep going. All right. And then the other pieces would really be that so much more of the testing is subjective. I think with the emphasis on the depths of CTRs, SARs, high-risk customer monitoring, just to name the first few that come to mind, there is so much more of that testing that is subjective. The filing instructions, FinCEN and FFIEC exam, you know, FFIEC have done a really good job with their resources. We've got filing instructions. We've got the examination manual. They are really, really excellent resources to start with. But are they the be all and end all? No. Are there still areas that just cause a lot of frustration for bankers out there that I would love to see some additional FAQs, some additional clarifications? Because doing audits, that's always a hard part, right? I want everything to be black and white. I want to be able to tell the client they're doing it right or they're not doing it right, and here's why they're not doing it right. And I feel that's the hard part, because there are definitely times where it might be different, but is what they're doing wrong, or is it just different and their operations? And sometimes what responses I hear back is, well, that's how our system works. I was like, okay, well, that's great. But does the OCC, does the FDIC, FRB, do they care to hear that answer? Or is there a little bit of a better answer that we can come up with? So certainly understanding the systems, trying to work through the subjectiveness of some of the testing. There's still some nice things that says, okay, did you get the four pieces of CIP? Did you identify the right information for completing a wire, for a monetary instrument? Those are still relatively black and white. But I would say, you know, those subjective areas of really trying to get into the meat of the audits takes so much longer now because we're also the bankers themselves are doing more things. We've got crypto, right? We've got cannabis. We've got video gaming in certain states. Those things weren't around, you know, 15, 20 years ago. They certainly weren't around in the level that they are now for bankers to have to worry about, thus meaning we've got auditors that need to understand those processes, you know, so much more than we did, again, yes, a decade to, you know, 15 years ago.
Yeah, and I think that's just going to continue. I keep seeing focuses about how AI is going to move into this realm also, and that's just going to really exacerbate the issue you point out of banks really needing to understand what's in the black box.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. Okay. So Helen, you deal with a lot of different banks. What have you heard or what have you seen the regulatory focus being lately?
Oh, that's always the magic question, isn't it? You know, I think we could attend webinars and in-person meetings with regulators across the country and we'd get different answers, right? East Coast, West Coast, OCC, FDIC, FRB, the state. You know, if they were all consistent, I think every bank would breathe a sigh of relief. They'd be really happy to know exactly what the regulators are looking at, right? One less thing that they have to kind of worry about and say, okay, well, is my regulator going to focus on my SAR testing? Are they going to focus on my high-risk customer reviews? Those are definitely two areas that seem to get everybody's attention. But with that being said, not necessarily consistently, right? We might have an East Coast OCC examiner that is very, very focused on high-risk customer reviews. Are they timely? Are they documented? Did the bank identify the right high-risk customers themselves? And then maybe we've got others, maybe from the FDIC or the FRB, that's not necessarily their focus. Maybe they're looking more from a policy procedure or risk assessment aspect of things. I guess where I've seen some consistency, and we can certainly look at recent consent orders, I will say that the regulators unanimously seem to be focusing on the appropriate level of BSA officer and their team, right? Make sure they're the right level in your institution. So are they just a figurehead or do they actually have some meat behind them where they can go to the board? They can stand up and stand on their own. Also, in addition to that, making sure the right staffing levels are in place. How many people do you have doing alerts? How many people are filing those 1,000 CTRs in a year? Is it relative to your organization? I've got some institutions that have what I think is a very well-established BSA department, compliance BSA department. Sometimes they're still kind of together. And I've got others that I think to myself, wow, you are really running lean. How do you get all that done? And so certainly from a staffing aspect, that's important. Make sure your examiner really does believe that your team can function in their roles, however big or however small, you know, those teams are. And then really, what I do find, though, frustrating is where sometimes it seems regulators go from zero to DEFCON 5 all within one audit period, exam period. It's like, okay, 18 months ago you came and the world was wonderful. 18 months later, we've now found every pillar violation on the planet. What happened? So again, I think that's a case of, you know, the bankers always make sure you're checking your program. You're really making sure your risk assessment is in line with what you say you do. Make sure you are providing regular reports to the board. I know it's cumbersome. I get it. I do understand that. But making sure that board, they truly are the stopgap when it comes to responsibility of your BSA program. And they also need to be accountable to understand what's happening from a day-to-day basis on, you know, how many SARs, how many CTRs. They don't have to get the granular detail, but they at least need to be aware of how much time is being spent on the BSA program. So I would say, you know, in general, your state regulators appear to be less critical in some areas than the FDIC and OCC. As I said, I would love to see, you know, FDIC on East Coast and West Coast be exactly the same, and same with OCC East and West. You know, I think just like the rest of us, we are seeing challenges within the, you know, employment market, right? We've got a lot of very well experienced examiners and bankers that are maybe at the tail end of their career. So they're now happily looking into retirement world. And there's a lot of, you know, newbies coming up. And I see that both from the banking side as well as the regulatory agency side. So everybody's got to find their niche, right? So I think from the stresses that that the bankers have to deal with, it's that unknown because they don't know what to expect from that regulator. They've seen where things were just peachy and now it's just completely changed. So they're in a little bit of a flux too, saying, well, you know, how do I know what to focus on? What are you going to get me for next? Almost. It's almost that gotcha, you know, phase, which is unfortunate in some cases. I really think a lot of our banks are trying to do the right thing. I don't think any of our BSA and compliance officers go to work each day and say, how can I mess something up today? That is not the mindset, you know, where we come from. We wouldn't be in these roles if it was. So I think it's just a case of, I think the regulators could do a better job of, you know, putting the word out of, you know, what are those expectations and where are we seeing the issues? I mean, I know it's, you know, published in different places, but I think there's so much inconsistency still in some of those areas that it makes it hard for the bankers really to feel good and say, okay, I know my OCC, my FDIC, my FRB, whoever it is going to be fine with my program. I can breathe another day.
Yeah. And I have to echo something you said, because I've seen it too. I feel like there's this old joke that someone says, how did you become the BSA officer? How did you become the compliance officer? And someone says, well, I missed a day of work and everybody nominated me. Yep. And I became the BSA officer. And it's like, I feel like recently regulators have just heard that joke and they're looking into it because yes. I have heard of a couple of banks recently that have had criticism over their BSA officer not having the experience, and likely because it was someone who was there and received that honored nomination to become the BSA officer.
And you're absolutely right. And that actually leads straight into one more thing. You know, on the risk assessment, make sure you identify your succession plan. You know, there's a lot of information that goes in their risk assessments, and sometimes it's, you know, it's boring, but it's needed information, right? But succession planning of your BSA team, the compliance team, whoever's in charge of doing the BSA functions, whether that's at a high level, whether that's the data analysts, the investigators, the fraud analysts, whoever it is, I've seen that there's not a lot of emphasis in the risk assessments that address succession planning. And yet I think it is so important. You know, while we never want to think about those bad situations where somebody just doesn't show up for work tomorrow because of, you know, a really negative effect, you know, something that's happened, but it does happen. And, you know, can these banks manage if all of a sudden they lost their BSA officer, they lost three of their BSA teams? What is their succession planning? And I certainly would question any bank, credit, and when I talk bank, of course, I also mean credit union, any institution where their senior compliance and BSA team, if they're looking to retire within that 5-year role, there should be some plans. And I know plans don't always go, you know, as expected. Sometimes people don't stay and they, you know, they've managed to groom their perfect BSA replacement and then they leave, right? I mean, how frustrating, I understand. But in those cases, having a succession plan is critical, because you're absolutely right. I do think the regulators are a little more attuned to that and realizing that, you know, there shouldn't just be one person that knows it all. Spread that wealth, share the, you know, the understanding and the knowledge, and certainly, you know, get it documented in a risk assessment.
Yeah, perfect. I couldn't have stated that any better. That's wonderful. So it's about time for us to wrap up. One last question before you go, Helen. What advice would you give to a new compliance or BSA officer about handling audits?
Gosh, what a question to end with. All right. Well, be organized, right? And be open. The organized part, hopefully it's part of their nature in general, because they got that role most probably by missing the meeting or, you know, not being at the right place at the right time. But assuming they actually do want the job, then at the organization is critical. Making sure that they, you know, understand you know, how an audit runs, right? And don't be the only person in the room or on the phone call when it comes to an audit. You know, invite your team members. The more that can understand that, some people get really nervous and stressed out over audits. And it is stressful, but it shouldn't have to be. So make sure you're organized. Plan for regular touch points with your auditor. Again, that doesn't have to be BSA only. BSA compliance, ACH, whatever it is, understand what that auditor is thinking. Don't wait till the end of that 1 week, 2 week, 3 week engagement, whatever that time frame is, to find out that you've got a laundry list of 16 items that now you've got to research and hopefully rebuttal some of those with, you know, updated documents, or realize that something, you know, was given to the auditor incorrectly, or whatever the reason being. But make sure that you engage with that audit. Don't just leave them to it and think, well, you haven't heard from in a week, things must be wonderful. Not necessarily. Make sure you have regular touch points. That's always one of the things that I do talk about with my banks and credit unions, and say, okay, this is how I run the audit. We will have touch points. So definitely make sure you find out how things are going. I've always said I want no surprises when we get to an exit meeting, right? My BSA officer, my compliance officer, whoever I'm working with, I want no surprises. I want them to be on the exact same page with me as we get to that exit meeting. They may not like everything, but I want them to be on the same page with me of what we've got to. And that's only going to happen if that banker is on the same page going through the whole audit process. And then be open to auditor comments. You know, we talked about, for a lot of this call, we've talked about subjectivity, right? So there isn't only one way to do everything. And it might be that maybe there's some inefficiencies going on, that the banker could actually glean some new information and some better ways to do something. So be open. We do have the wonderful opportunity of seeing lots of different clients, and they don't all do things the same way. Some do them better than others. Some we wish they could do it differently. But in general, there are definitely some ways that they can, you know, find some improvements and ask questions. You know, I know it's an audit. Don't start rambling on about, you know, these 16 other things you want to talk to your auditor about. But there's a time and place to also, you know, glean some information and some efficiencies. So I would just say, be open to ideas, but also be ready to push back. If you think you've got an auditor that is being, you know, maybe a tad bit unfair or cannot support their findings, absolutely, don't sit back and just take that. Don't wait till the report comes out. Make sure that you're having those conversations right there and then through the time of the audit, or as soon as you know about them, to be able to counteract that. And that should be the same for an exam as well. We don't ever want to think that an auditor or an examiner is giving incorrect information, but there may be some times that, you know, it does need to be, you know, pushed back and rebutted. So those would be the points that I would, you know, definitely suggest to any new BSA or, you know, compliance officer in general, in how to manage audits.
Perfect. I couldn't agree more. Those are great takeaways. Helen, thank you for joining me today and talking about BSA.
Well, again, thank you for the invite, Ashton. Really appreciated the chance to talk with you.
And for the rest of our listeners, that's Banking Matters.